You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening. It is 5:07, and it's time for another hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from Vancouver, federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Also today, we will be discussing the controversial Keystone Pipeline project with Dr. George Hoberg, right here in our studio. Dr. Hoberg is a professor at the Department of Forest Resources Management at the Faculty of Forestry at the University of British Columbia, and we'll be talking to him about the environmental impact of the Keystone Pipeline project.
All this, plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent local, national, and international news.
But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Alice Olstein with headlines for FSRN. In Libya, the National Transitional Council declared the country liberated this weekend. Photos of the body of Muammar Gaddafi are raising concerns over how and why the ex-leader was killed. UN Human Rights Office spokesperson Rupert Colville is calling for an investigation into Gaddafi's death and says he should have been spared in order to stand trial for his crimes.
When there are such serious charges against people, you always want to see them in court. And because of the rigorousness of court proceedings and what they require of the prosecution, it can be a very important element in a transitional justice situation that people get a clearer picture of what was happened, who's responsible for what.
And on Sunday, Human Rights Watch discovered the bodies of 53 apparent Gaddafi loyalists in a Sirte hotel, and the group is demanding that those responsible for the mass execution be brought to justice. As violence escalates in Syria, U.S. Ambassador Robert Ford is temporarily returning to Washington. Ford has been outspoken in his support for those protesting President Bashar al-Assad, which has made him the target of multiple threats and acts of intimidation. U.S. State Department spokesperson Mark Toner told reporters Monday that Ford's return to Damascus depended on an assessment of Syrian regime-led incitement and the security situation on the ground. The U.N. Security Council unanimously passed a resolution late Friday calling for a peaceful transition of power in Yemen and an immediate end to the violence and political repression. The resolution backs a proposal from the Gulf Cooperation Council, which calls for President Ali Abdullah Saleh to transfer power to his vice president, followed by the formation of an interim government, a new constitution, and elections. But Amnesty International is criticizing the announcement, saying it gives President Saleh immunity from investigation and prosecution. Rescue operations are underway in eastern Turkey, following a 7.2 magnitude earthquake on Sunday afternoon near the city of Van on the Iranian border. Hermione G. reports from Istanbul.
The death toll from Sunday's earthquake now stands at 239, according to government officials, with around 1,300 people injured. Turkey's Interior Minister, Idris Naim Sahin, said that while the number of dead is expected to increase, the figures are not likely to be as bad as initially feared. The small city of Edjish, 55 miles north of Van, took the brunt of the tremor, and around 80 multi-story buildings collapsed, including 4 or 5 apartment blocks and a student dormitory. Rescue operations were initially hampered by power outages and frequent aftershocks, but many survivors have been pulled from the rubble. The Turkish Red Crescent is setting up tents, field hospitals, and kitchens for people left homeless by the earthquake, but many residents still spent Sunday night outdoors in near-freezing temperatures. Hermione G., FSRN, Istanbul.
Israel and Egypt are nearing a prisoner exchange deal that would free 20 to 30 Egyptians from Israeli jails in return for the release of an Israeli-American student. 27-year-old Alon Grappel, a former IDF paratrooper, was detained in Tahrir Square last June on espionage charges. Israeli officials say the deal won't go forward until the recently signed Palestinian-Israeli prisoner swap is complete. Millions of Tunisian citizens lined up at the polls Sunday for the nation's first free democratic election. Officials say participation topped 90% as voters selected delegates for the upcoming constituent assembly that will draft a new constitution. The moderate Islamist party Ennahda has a reported early lead in many districts. The formerly banned group has said that even if it wins a majority of the 217-seat assembly, it will join a coalition with other parties to create a government that represents all Tunisians. Protesters in London have maintained a tent city outside St. Paul's Cathedral since the Occupy Wall Street movement went global in mid-October. But officials from the cathedral and the City of London say the camp creates health and safety problems, and they're trying to evict the protesters. FSRN's Naomi Fowler reports.
Protesters tried to bring their message directly to the London Stock Exchange, but St. Paul's Cathedral's as close as they can get to London's financial district. One of the protesters told the crowd why he was moved to set up camp.
The current system is unsustainable. It is undemocratic and unjust. We need alternatives. This is where we work towards them.
Cathedral officials have closed St. Paul's to visitors since Friday and say they're losing around $30,000 of revenue a day. Yet Christian groups such as Ecclesia, Christianity Uncut and the London Catholic Worker are calling on the cathedral to support the movement. They say resisting economic injustice with non-violence is in complete alignment with religious values. It's a direct challenge to church authorities, just as they're consulting with lawyers alongside City of London officials to evict the campers. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
Occupy encampments in the U.S. are also struggling. 15 were arrested at Occupy Philadelphia on Sunday during a sit-in against police brutality. And in Portland, Maine, the protesters' camp was attacked with a homemade bomb. There were no major injuries, but organizers say they fear more acts of violence. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Washington, D.C., I'm Alice Olstein.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at FSRN.org. I'm Martin Lemlin.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101 right here on CITR 101.9 FM. And these are your local headlines.
Canadian and Mexican travelers are once again going to have to swallow a $5.50 tax if they enter the United States by air or sea. A U.S.-Colombia free trade deal passed last Friday includes a clause that removes an exemption from the tariff for travelers from Canada, Mexico, and the Caribbean. Canada and Mexico had been exempt from the fee since 1997 under the North America Free Trade Agreement, but American politicians needing fresh cash for government coffers have resurrected it. International Trade Minister Ed Fast said the Canadian government is disappointed and that the raising taxes at the border just raises costs on consumers and it will continue to raise Canada's concerns with U.S. lawmakers. The return of the tariff comes as Canada and the U.S. are supposed to be finalizing the details of the Beyond Borders deal, which officials say will improve trade and security at the same time.
Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robertson says the city is negotiating with Occupy Vancouver demonstrators to end their protests peacefully. About 100 protesters continue to camp on the lawn of the Vancouver Art Gallery just over a week after the protests began. Last week, the city said the protests had already cost more than $500,000 in additional policing and city resources, and critics have called on Robertson to take immediate action to dismantle the tent city outside the gallery. Mayor Robertson said forcibly removing demonstrators is not the answer. He said the protesters are not willing to do so yet, so to set a hard date and say the city will move them may be very irresponsible and it only inflames the situation right now. The protests are inspired by Occupy Wall Street, a grassroots movement that has spread to more than 80 countries and featured demonstrations against global financial inequality and corporate greed.
A coroner's inquest looking into a fatal fire at an illegal boarding house on Pandora Street began in Vancouver this morning. Three men, Garland McKay, Dwayne Rasmussen, and Stephen Yellowquill, died of smoke inhalation in the fire on December 22, 2010. Harry Kays, one of the seven people living in the home at the time of the fire, told the inquest on Monday morning that he was just returning home when he heard a popping sound, and smoke began filling the house. Kays testified he rented a room at the house for $400 a month, and there were always plumbing and electrical problems, he said, but the repairs were never made, so eventually he stopped complaining to the landlord. He added there was no smoke detectors, alarms, or fire extinguishers in the home, and a fire inspector, is expected to testify.
Cope City Council candidate Tim Lewis promised voters he will push for a UPass similar setup for local communities to help families deal with affordability issues and sustainability. Under his community UPass, Lewis said people in a neighborhood would be encouraged to buy passes as a group. The more people that buy in, the greater the discount there will be on the pass, since the transit authority would adjust the price based on the revenue collected in the community beforehand. Lewis said it is a bulk transit buying. All people have to do, according to him, is take the idea and apply it to the wider community.
Mayor Gregert Robertson and the Vision Vancouver team pledged to help seniors in crisis, build new childcare spaces, and increase police numbers, as they unveiled in their platform policies for the upcoming civic election. Robertson promised to create a minimum of 500 new childcare spaces over the next 3 years, increasing funding to hire new police officers, and provide training for city staff to help Alzheimer's or dementia at-risk seniors to stay safe. The platform also pledges upgrades for fire and rescue services and facilities and increased disaster response capacity.
Those are your local headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 right here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
The Biltmore Cabaret is your home for great live music in Vancouver.
October is sure to be a busy month at the Biltmore. On October 6th, catch bands Hollow Moon, The Bleeding Hearts, and Pineapple, a supergroup featuring members of the SSRIs, Portage in the Main, and Prairie Cat. October 21st, jam out with Daydream Vacation, indie rocker Zeus, and local favorites Sun Wizard. For fans of the New Pornographers, you won't want to miss band member Catherine Calder and special guest Anime Bell on October 27th. To round out your month, October 29th brings the band Nurses all the way up from Portland to share the stage with Dominant Legs.
For more information on these and other shows, including how to get tickets, visit BiltmoreCabaret.com.
Hello, I'm Kent Brockman, and this is Eye on
Shindig. Shindig is CITR's annual Battle of the Bands that goes down 9 p.m. every Tuesday night at the Railway Club until a winner is crowned. October 18th, come out to see The Godspot, Honorary MD, and Velociraptor. October 25th, Shindig brings you The Fathoms, From Birch to You, and Rec Center. Read all about it at shindig.citr.ca.
Welcome back to News 101, right here at CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. In our next segment, we'd like to discuss the Keystone XL pipeline project, a proposed 2,600-kilometer-long pipeline that is phase four of the Keystone project. The pipeline starts from Hardisty, Alberta, crosses the border, and heads south to Steel City in Nebraska. To discuss this project and its hotly debated potential environmental impacts, we have here with us Dr. George Hoberg. Dr. Hoberg is a professor at the Department of Forest Resources Management at the Faculty of Forestry at the University of British Columbia. Welcome to the show, Dr. Hoberg.
Thank you.
Well, we'd like to begin by talking a bit about what the pipeline project is. And tell us a bit about the Alberta oil sands.
Okay, well, the oil sands are a very, very large deposit of what's referred to in the trade as unconventional oil, rather than the stuff you can just pump out of the ground. It's a source of oil that needs significantly more processing in order to make it economically useful. It's actually not oil or tar. It's bitumen, a petroleum product that's mixed in with sand and clay. So you have to wash that stuff out and then find a way to transform that bitumen into what's referred to as synthetic crude oil. And all those things require intensive amount of disturbance of land, intensive amount of water, and an intensive amount of energy input, which creates a lot of greenhouse gas output.
Right. I was actually reading reading a bit about the bitumen extraction process, and apparently they have to burn 1 billion cubic feet of natural gas a day.
It's a lot.
That I cannot even begin to imagine.
I mean, one of the biggest sources of natural gas demand in Canada in the next decade or so will be the oil sands.
The oil sands. Well, tell us a bit about when the Keystone Pipeline project began, because we, as far as we understand, this is phase four that is being discussed.
So the first phases have been are already in operation. A couple of years ago, the main Keystone Pipeline was approved and then built, and it just began operation recently. What they're talking about doing now is extending it to create a more direct line from the oil sands to two places, Cushing, Oklahoma, which already has a lot of refineries, and they want to increase the amount of oil product flowing through there. But most importantly, from the American viewpoint, to get it to the Gulf Coast down in Texas and Louisiana, which is a huge aggregation of refineries that are well-suited to upgrade and process this kind of oil.
So as we understand through our research, a lot of people are clearly opposed to the construction of Phase 4.
Yes, indeed.
Tell us a bit about why.
Well, there's really two sources of opposition. One comes from the people along the pipeline route who are concerned particularly about the risk of a pipeline rupture and its impact on water resources. The biggest concern really is the big aquifers that are underneath Nebraska in particular that are a fundamental source of drinking water and irrigation for that area. So they're precious resources to people. So it's created some amount of local opposition, and that's been focused in the state of Nebraska, where the governor has actually gotten quite adamant about this and has just called a special session of the legislature to discuss it. But the broader source of opposition really is the climate movement in the U.S. and even throughout North America, because they have been so frustrated at trying to gain leverage over the American policy process and been so stymied by the complex procedures there. They've chosen to focus on the Keystone XL pipeline because it's an issue that President Obama, who they thought was a friend of theirs, has direct decision-making authority over. Congress is not involved in this directly. And so it's been chosen by the climate movement is really they're drawing a line in the oil sands in this case, that to try to block a major project that they see as being an increased risk to climate.
So what about the fact that sorry, I'm trying to get my words here, but tell us a bit about the oil spills themselves. We've looked into the fact that there have been several oil spills in the Peace River, in the Bow River, in the Yellowstone River, for example. And these have had devastating impacts on the ecology around these rivers.
Yes.
So are these potential problems in the future for the pipeline?
Yes. My own personal view is that for a land-based pipeline, the risks of ruptures of the pipeline and the impacts of that are relatively modest compared to the greenhouse gas impacts. The reason I'm concerned about the Keystone XL is not because of that, but you know, I don't live along the route, so that's easy for me to say, and I appreciate and understand those people who are concerned about their resources. A lot of the studies that have been done about the aquifer and other things suggest that the spills, while they if they occur, and they're likely to occur, there's some probability they'll occur, will significantly affect a relatively small area. They don't spread out if they're land-based. That's the difference between, say, the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico or the Exxon Valdez oil spill, which had huge impacts because all the oil is transported by ocean currents.
Absolutely.
Most of the area here is relatively dry, prairie-type land, and so the impacts of the spill will not be as great.
So it's not necessarily likely or common that the pipeline rupture or break. It's more the process of extracting the oil that is, at least personally for you, that's more...
Well, for me, I worry much more about the so-called upstream effects, you know, what happens in the oil sands region.
Right.
And the downstream effects, what happens when the stuff gets to the Gulf Coast and gets turned into synthetic crude oil and then into petroleum products, about all the pollution and other environmental effects that occur then. The pipeline itself, in this case, there will be, I believe that, you know, there's a probability that there will be ruptures and there will be spills. The question is how significant those are. They'll probably be relatively localized. There could be a circumstance which it could be worse. But those risks to the environment, in my view, are less than the risks of the expanded oil sands production we're going to get and the expanded downstream processing of those oil sands products.
Tell us a bit about the production of the oil. I mean, if you're talking about the significant amount of greenhouse gases that are expelled during the production of this process, what are the things that the government, the federal government, is trying to do to try to take care of the situation?
We're talking the federal government of Canada here.
Yes,
the federal government of Canada, with respect to the oil sands and their greenhouse gases, is doing nothing. It's disgraceful. In Canada, we have a system that decentralizes environmental regulation a great deal, so that we let the provinces decide how they're going to deal with greenhouse gases, with some exceptions. We regulate federally greenhouse gases from automobiles, and we regulate them. We're about to impose a new standard on coal, new coal-fired power plants, which could actually make a significant difference in Canada. The federal government has occasionally said it's planning to introduce regulations on the oil sands for greenhouse gases, but so far it hasn't. So it leaves it up to the government of Alberta. The government of Alberta has done is they have a plan to reduce what's called the emission intensity of oil sands. So they want to have fewer greenhouse gases per barrel of oil produced. And that's progress. But if you're going to dramatically increase the amount of oil produced, the amount of carbon is still going to go up. And that's going to contribute to the dangerous climate situation that we're headed towards.
So nationally, on our side of the border, there's no opposition or even interest in the pipeline construction. It's just because this is an American decision, right?
This decision is an American decision, okay? But the Keystone Pipeline starts in Hardisty, mm-hmm. Alberta, and so it crosses Canadian land until it gets to the American border.
Yeah.
The National Energy Board has already reviewed and approved that.
In March.
Without opposition. But we have our own oil sands pipelines, the ones that are being talked about through British Columbia, through the Northern Gateway pipeline to Kitimat, which is immensely controversial. Mm-hmm. And there's also controversy over the existing pipeline that we have from Edmonton to Burnaby, right in our backyard, that ships oil sands products that we put on tankers and move out of the Vancouver harbor into the international market. And they're talking about doubling production there. So that's also a source. So there's a lot of concern about those new pipelines in the West, but the Keystone XL pipeline, the Canadian version of it, didn't get any controversy. It's been very controversial in the U.S.
And pretty well received on our side of the border, apparently.
Well, wasn't particularly noticed. I think that's the best way to put it.
Flew in under the radar
a little bit. The environmentalists were busy doing other things and chose not to make an issue out of it. Hmm.
So do you think that the reason they're building a phase four is because they want to increase production? We've heard reports that that is not the case, but we disagree here. Do you think that's
they want the to increase production of the oil sands?
Yeah,
so we're expected to double the production of oil sands over the next 10 years. So the oil industry, the government of Alberta, government of Canada, all are planning for a very significant increase in the production of oil sands. The question is where it goes to. And Canada would like to see a diverse market. So getting it to the Gulf Coast is great because it feeds the American market and it can also be exported out of there to elsewhere. We'd also like the government of Canada and government of Alberta and oil companies want to move it out west through British Columbia so they can get it to China and India. So they can have a more diverse market. So there are production increases expected very significantly, and the pipeline capacity issue is a question of just where it will go. One of the things that the defenders of Keystone say is you shouldn't really worry about things like the greenhouse gas emissions from it, because if they don't come through the Keystone XL pipeline, they'll increase oil sands production and ship it elsewhere, like out to China. Right. And that's something that could be true, but it'll be interesting to see if the Keystone XL pipeline was not approved, would the government of Canada be able to get the Northern Gateway pipeline out of Kitimat to China approved? And a lot of Canadian environmentalists and a lot of First Nations are very opposed to that.
Not necessarily go unnoticed. Have the other three phases seen as much opposition?
There's been virtually no opposition to the rest of it.
No. It's just the fact that it's because it's crossing the border, it's a federal...
Well, you have to understand the nature of politics over the last several years. These generally haven't been particularly big issues. Mm-hmm. Oil spills have become a huge issue because of the BP incident in the right. Gulf and then the big spill in Kalamazoo, Michigan last summer. So that put oil spills on the radar in a way that they weren't before. So landowners and others who have been relatively friendly to pipelines going through their backyard because they get compensated for them now are a lot more nervous. More importantly, the big driver here is that the U.S. climate movement is desperately trying to seek an issue to try to mobilize the public to get them to pay attention. And they've chosen this. And that's why it's such a big issue. That's why, you know, it's been on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine, for example. And that's because a relatively widespread, powerful social movement has chosen to make an issue out of it.
So I guess all of us here agree that there are definitely certain political influences behind this pipeline between Alberta and Nebraska. But do you think there's bound to be a change in political influences within the climate movement itself? Like, are people going to start expecting their politicians to start putting pressure on oil companies and oil lobbyists and...
Well, that's certainly the great hope of the climate movement. They're hoping that they can influence Barack Obama directly, and they're hoping that they can get enough public attention that politicians will sit up and take notice. Do you think that's happening so far? The polls show it's not. People in the climate movement are extremely discouraged. They were hoping that the Keystone XL would light a fire under a broader range of the public. I don't see that happening. Now, what's happened instead is very interesting, that the Occupy Wall Street movement and its associates around the world have taken over the kind of social activism impulse. And that's exciting from the perspective of seeing widespread social mobilization, but it's not at all focused on climate issues.
So give us an example of what exactly the Obama administration could do in terms of making a policy to change the impact of the pipeline or change the construction of the pipeline itself.
Okay, so Barack Obama has to declare that the pipeline is in the national interest. That's up to him.
Right.
So he could just say it's not. It's not in the national interest because it'll increase U.S. dependence on foreign oil and it'll increase environmental risk to the pipeline and it'll increase greenhouse gases. But it looks like he will approve it. Because the economic situation is so dire in the United States that if he's considered to be standing in the way of new projects that will bring jobs, even if they're just temporary construction jobs, then that'll really hurt him politically.
Is there a cap on when this decision has to be made?
Not yet. We have all the information needed. The final environmental impact statement has been delivered, and the State Department has to give 90 days between that and when it recommends to the president whether it's in the national interest.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know whether it's allowed to take more than that.
All right.
But we're expecting a decision from the State Department by the end of the year and then by Obama shortly thereafter.
So roughly March?
It may even be before then. Obama might as well just get it over with.
Yeah.
If he's going to approve it, just approve it and deal with the political backlash and move on.
And the governor of Nebraska, the session that he's planning on November 1st, he doesn't actually oppose the pipeline, right? He just wants to reroute it?
Well, he opposes building it on top of the aquifer that they have, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if they reroute it around Nebraska, he doesn't have any jurisdiction or any stakes. He's not opposed to it for greenhouse gas reasons. He's opposed to it because his constituents are opposed to it.
And his drinking water might be at stake.
Yeah.
You just mentioned the environmental impact statement. What agency is responsible for that statement?
Okay, so in this case, because it crosses the Canada-U.S. border, it's the U.S. Department of State that takes responsibility for preparing the environmental impact statement. So it's under Hillary Clinton's jurisdiction as Secretary of State.
Right. And what does that assess? Does it do a cost-benefit analysis?
Yeah, it's very comprehensive. It looks at economic impacts in terms of jobs and changing oil supply and demand throughout the United States. It looks at a wide variety of environmental impacts, from the local things about risks to the global impacts on greenhouse gases. So if you're interested, you could just Google Keystone XL Environmental Impact Statement, State Department, and it's relatively easy to find, and it has a 25-page executive summary that's quite comprehensive.
Great. Well, a couple of last words. Do you want to do you have something to say to members of the Occupy movement, and maybe perhaps give them a couple of ideas on how they could help change things within the federal government, or help them make policy decisions, I guess?
Well, I'm not sure I have any direct suggestions for them. I would strongly encourage them to include climate in their list of concerns.
I have heard that, as a matter of fact, in their general assemblies, in their statements.
I mean, I've been down there, and I'm heading down there this evening. I don't have a sense that it's a high priority for them. From my perspective, we really face a very urgent climate crisis, and if we don't act within the next decade or half a decade, we're going to face a very serious problem. And it's very exciting to see this kind of mobilization about economic justice. If it's not reframed to focus on climate justice, we're going to have much bigger problems than we currently have now worldwide.
What sort of problems would happen within 10 years?
The problems are not likely to happen within 10 years.
But if
if we don't act within 10 years to begin transforming the climate system, then the problems show up 20 to 30 years later. So they're now saying, people have been using this safe level of climate change, about 2 degrees. 2 degrees is already risky, a 2 degrees warming. There's just studies out today. There's an article in the Vancouver Sun reporting new journal articles in Nature saying that if we don't turn down climate emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, by 2020, we'll be seeing significant effects beyond the 2 degree limit by 2030. So I hope that's within my lifetime. Should be. It's certainly going to be when you're before you're my age. the proverbial stuff is going to be hitting the fan in terms of climate, and by that point, it'll be too late to change it. Mm-hmm. We need to act now.
What are the one thing that puts out the most emissions in modern life? Is it seem to recall airplanes, but
airplanes are very small.
I believe it's still cars.
The two biggest sources are how you get around, so transportation in cars in particular, and how we get our electricity. In BC, we're virtually carbon free, but most of the rest of the continent gets its electricity from coal and natural gas, which is very carbon intensive. I do want to say some stuff, if I can, before I go, about the carbon intensity of oil sands and about that issue with respect to Keystone XL, because I oppose the pipeline, because I think it's important to draw a line in the sand on these sorts of carbon projects, because I see this dire climate emergency that I've discussed. But the amount of greenhouse gases that are likely to increase out of the pipeline are, in fact, very small. Oil sands are more greenhouse gas intensive than conventional sources of oil. But it's not that big a difference compared to how big a difference it would be if people drove substantially less. And just to give you some numbers, if you think about the difference between if you take that stuff out of the, from when it's under the ground to getting it to the gate of the refinery, oil sands are about 3 times more carbon intensive than conventional oil, which sounds like a lot. But if you look at it from getting it out of the ground to having it turn the wheels of your car, it's only about 15% more carbon intensive. And again, that's a significant difference. But if you are concerned about greenhouse gases and climate change, as you should be, the most effective solution would be to dramatically reduce demand for fossil fuels. Drive less. That's much more important than it is whether we use oil from the oil sands or Saudi Arabia or Venezuela. Mm-hmm. So that's the main message that I want to... It's very important to think about the whole system that we have and figure out where the source of emissions are and where we can make the most difference. And we can make the most difference by changing the way we use fossil fuels.
Absolutely. Most people tend to forget that it's really up to us to decide where that oil ends up. Does it end up in our tank or does it stay?
Yeah, so it's up to us, but it's very hard for us to act because we all have our own. We want convenience and all that stuff. So
that's true.
It's up to the government to get the prices right and the regulatory framework right. It's a disgrace that governments haven't acted to internalize the costs of damages to the environment. We need an effective economy-wide price on carbon, and that needs to happen as soon as possible. And in order for that to happen, politicians need to know that the public wants that to happen. So the most important thing you could do, and this is why it connects to the Occupy movement, the most important thing you could do to change things is get in the face of politicians and let them know that you care about this, and you're going to, next time they're up for election, you're going to vote on whether or not they pursue serious climate policies.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely important. Whoever's listening, please vote in your next election. Mm-hmm.
And come and take my course in the spring, Conservation 425, where we pursue these issues in a lot more detail.
That's great. Dr. George Hober, could you tell us a bit about where we could reach you, reach more of your work, for example, maybe a blog?
Sure. I have a blog called Green Policy Prof. So if you just Google George Hober blog, that's great. You can find my email on through the internet as well. I am a regular user of Twitter, and I follow pipeline issues and climate issues very closely. So if you're interested in this stuff, follow me on Twitter. It's just at G. Hoberg.
Thank you very much, Doctor. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hoberg. That was George Hoberg talking to us about the Keystone Pipeline Project. Well, we'll be taking a quick break, but stay with us. We'll be back with some more news. You're listening to News 101 here at CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Welcome back to News 101 here at CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia here in Vancouver. Up next, we have your weekly weather forecast brought to you by the Storm Club.
It is currently 10 degrees at UBC with mainly clear skies. The normal temperatures for this time of year are a maximum of 12 and a minimum of 5 degrees. There is currently an area of high pressure off the coast of the U.S., which will give us clear skies tomorrow before a low pressure system moves in from the North Pacific on Wednesday, bringing rain. There will be a break in the weather Thursday before the next system arrives on Friday. Here's your 7-day forecast for UBC. This evening to overnight will be partly cloudy with a low of 4 degrees. Tuesday will be sunny with a high of 11 degrees. Tuesday night will be clear with a low of 4 degrees. On Wednesday, it will rain with a high of 10 degrees. Thursday will be partly cloudy with a low of 5 and a high of 10 degrees. For Friday, it will rain, a low of 6 and a high of 11 degrees. Saturday will be partly cloudy with showers, a low of 6 and a high of 11 degrees. And for Sunday, it will be cloudy with a chance of showers, a low of 6 and a high of 12. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Greg Allen.
Thank you, Greg, for that weather update for this week.
Yeah, thanks. It looks like we only have 24 hours before it rains for the rest of our lives. It's a bit of a bummer. But thanks for bringing us the news anyways. So, David Suzuki was at the Occupy movement this Saturday, right?
Yes, on the 22nd of October.
And you were there to take in the festivities?
Absolutely.
There was a bit of a kerfuffle, but some controversy about letting him on stage. I guess it was a scheduling issue?
It was. I mean, a couple of people in the crowd had issues about him talking during the General Assembly. That was also planned at 1 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
But after consensus, so they say, they agreed to let him talk.
In any case, we have that talk, don't we?
We do. And up next, News 101 is going to play you David Suzuki's speech at Occupy Vancouver on the 22nd of October outside the Vancouver Art Gallery.
We get voted off the island. I want to say right at the beginning that I'm speaking to you as a private citizen. I don't represent or speak on behalf of any organization or group. I'd also like to begin by acknowledging that we are gathered here on Coast Salish ground. I want to thank the organizers of today's program for inviting me to share a few ideas with you. I believe the Occupy movement could be absolutely historic, but we won't know for years from now. I believe what it is a demand for open dialogue, for conversation in which disparate voices, we've already heard some of them, will be heard. And I am here as much to listen and learn as I am to speak. But I'm especially grateful then for being given this time at the beginning to present my ideas first. Let me be transparent with my motives, as I hope you ask all speakers to be. I have an agenda. I am an elder, and I'm long past the seduction of fame or money or power. I speak to you today as a grandparent with four young children and a fifth on the way. And I've seized this opportunity to speak about their future, a future far less rich in biodiversity and natural abundance than when I was a child. My generation and the boomers who followed have lived like kings and queens and thoughtlessly partied as if there's no tomorrow. We forgot the lessons taught to us by our parents and grandparents who came through the Great Depression. Live within your means. Save some for tomorrow. Satisfy your needs, not your wants. Help your neighbors, because someday they will help you. Share, don't be greedy. Money doesn't make you a better person or more important person. Well, the party's over. We've got to remember those old aphorisms, clean up our mess, and start thinking about our grandchildren. I'm a scientist, and what we do is to probe the mysteries of the cosmos to uncover laws and principles that explains what's going on in the world and how we can live within it. Physics tells us we can't build a rocket that will travel faster than the speed of light. I know at CERN they're saying maybe 6 kilometers faster than the speed of light, but don't hold your breath on that one. Physics tells us the law of gravity applies to all objects on Earth. That entropy means perpetual motion machines are not possible. Those are the laws of physics, and we live within them. In chemistry, diffusion constants, reaction rates, atomic properties set the limits of chemical reactions and the kinds of molecules that we can synthesize. Biology dictates our absolute need for clean air, clean water, clean soil, clean energy, and biodiversity in order for us to survive and live in a healthy way. Those are laws of nature, and we can't change them. We have to live within their boundaries. Many other things are not forces of nature. We draw lines around our property, around cities, provinces, and countries. And boy, do we take them. Importantly, we will go to war, kill, and die to protect those borders. But you know what? Nature couldn't care less about human borders. Air, water, dust, storms, drought, global warming, fires, epidemics, migrating birds, fish, mammals, and insects pay no attention to our ideas of territory. Other things, capitalism, economies, corporations, markets, and currency, these are not forces of nature. We invented them. And if they don't work, we can and we must change them. Look at what happened in Copenhagen. 192 nations gathered to deal with the atmosphere that belongs to no one. 192 national borders, 192 economic priorities, trying to shoehorn nature to fit our agendas. It will never work unless we subordinate our priorities to the limits imposed by nature itself. For me, the Occupy movement is about ecos, the Greek word for household or domain. It's about defining our place in community, in the state, in the nation, and in the biosphere. What is our home? And how do we live in it sustainably, with opportunity and meaning and happiness as our highest aspirations? Oikos is home. Ecology is the study of home. Economics is its management. But we elevate economy above ecology. For 5 years, the Prime Minister of Canada has never acknowledged the reality of human-induced climate change or that Canada is the industrialized nation most vulnerable to its impact. And now he's cutting back on scientists in Environment Canada and research on climate, so then we don't have to listen to the facts. Mr. Harper has steadfastly said, we can't reduce greenhouse gas emissions because it will destroy the economy. First of all, it's not true. Sweden, a northern industrialized country like us, has a carbon tax, has reduced its greenhouse gas emissions 8% below 1990 levels, while its economy grew by 44%. But more egregious, Mr. Harper lifts the economy above the very air that keeps us alive. Let's put the eco back into economics. There's an old saying that money talks. I've talked to a lot of loonies, but they've all been people. Money may literally talk, may not literally talk, but today it controls and sets the agenda for our governments. Occupy is not just about the 1% who continue to rake in an ever-increasing proportion of society's wealth, while 99% bear the real cost. Occupy is about corporate power. Corporations have become bigger than most governments on the planet, and they are no longer bound by national borders, laws, or standards. Occupiers know, because so many of you are young, that the terrible inequities represented by the 1% today are also intergenerational. Today's corporations and the super rich are increasing wealth at the expense of generations to come, exhausting resources, extinguishing species, poisoning air, water, and soil. Yet economists discount the estimated costs of these problems that will be most strongly felt by successive generations to come. Have you ever heard a politician call for mass spending for the sake of future generations, or children who can't vote, or for youth who don't bother to vote? Why does the government that we elect to look after our well-being and our future act as a cheerleader for corporate sectors? Because money talks. For years, the auto sector fought every progressive innovation, from seat belts to catalytic converters to mileage targets to airbags. It will cost too much. We'll be put out of business. Let the markets rule. Don't legislate. Trust us, is what they said. For 10 years, Chrysler had data that proved airbags saved lives. Yet for years, the auto sector fought Ralph Nader, while hundreds of thousands of people who could have been saved by airbags died. And when their beloved free market shifted to favor foreign companies, those bastions of free enterprise came crawling to governments and asked for bailouts. David Lewis was right, they're corporate welfare bums. And they got the money. But they got the money with very few strings attached. Why does our government, Ag Canada, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, act like cheerleaders for GMOs, declaring them substantially equivalent to normal food and thus not requiring special standards of safety, yet denying the requirement of labeling so at least we can choose what to eat? Money talks. Just ask Monsanto.
Well, that was David Suzuki speaking at Occupy Vancouver on October 22nd, right outside the Vancouver Art Gallery.
It is unfortunate, but that's our program for today, October 24th, 2011. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us a hot news tip, please don't hesitate to contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334. Or you can email us at news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter under the username CITRNews. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us every Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Martin Lemelin.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by Chirag Mahajan, Martin, and Iqbal, with help from Louise and Nina. From the entire news team here at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for
Sore Throats Clapping Hands.
Sore Throats and Clapping Hands at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM.